This is Catch 22 Minutes. Hello and welcome everyone to another episode of Catch 22 podcast. This is Stella Tzedekidou. I'm head of policy and campaigns at Catch 22. And today we're talking about Job Centers Plus. In particular, why does everyone hate Job Centers Plus? And what do they say about the punitive approach that we have been seeing in the UK in terms of getting people back to work? And what does that say about our welfare system? What does it say about our politics? And how do we change or improve that? With me to discuss this, I have Tom O'Grady. Tom, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, thank you very much for having me. So my name is Tom O'Grady. I'm an associate professor of politics at UCL, and I'm the author of a recent book, which is kind of a history of welfare reforms in the UK, called The Transformation of British Welfare Policy, which came out in 2022.
Great, amazing, Tom. Can you tell me a bit about why you chose to focus on this area? Are there any particular elements of welfare policy that you focused on in your research?
Sure. Well, the book is both a kind of history of what's happened, but it's more an attempt to understand why it's happened. And the reason why I think it's important to understand why it's happened is that this British welfare reforms, particularly since 2010, have been incredibly far-reaching, and they've had very far-reaching effects, particularly on the poorest and most vulnerable in society. And those changes have been very different to changes in other similar countries facing similar sets of challenges. And so part of the aim of the book is really to understand why these changes have taken place and to try to learn some of the lessons from the last decade for what might come next in welfare policy. So it's as much an account of the politics of welfare reform as it is an account of what's happened. And I guess the main thrust of the book is a history of the kind of moral language that we've used to talk about welfare, and an account of the ways in which our language, particularly from politicians and the media, has really influenced the way that the public thinks about welfare, and in turn the way that welfare policy itself has been implemented. So it's a kind of causal story, if you like, where the kind of discourse around welfare has affected the way we think about it. And I use that causal story then to think later in the book about how politicians should approach welfare policy in future in such a way that I guess their language and their approach kind of generates public support rather than undermines it, which I think is what the book shows happened both over the 1990s, 2000s and over the start of the 2010s.
This is very interesting, and I could ask you a million questions about this, about the language in particular that we use when we discuss welfare policy. It's something that I have been observing a lot in politics. It's basically politicians setting up their own trap. They adopt the language of people with different policies from them and from, you know, the media and newspapers, or even just voters who they want. They want these voters to vote for them. And so they adopt language that they think will appeal to them. But this language then eventually means that they will have to, leads to policies that are ineffective, or just that they don't agree with their own politics, but they have basically locked themselves into doing that. And we see that with criminal justice policy a lot. We saw that with austerity a lot. With the immigration system, we saw that a lot. But if we focus on welfare policy for a bit, can you tell me, where do Job Centers Plus come in? What has been the journey of Job Centers Plus in the last couple of decades? And how does the way that we speak about Job Centers Plus, I guess, influence how politicians have tried to change them, or the way that the way that they function in our welfare system?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main journey that Job Centers Plus have been on is one where they've increasingly been given over the last two decades, and it's not just in the last decade, it also happened a bit under New Labour as well. They've been given an increasingly dual and in some sense contradictory mandate, where job centres are required to do two things. They're first of all required to help get people back into work, so they have a kind of positive goal, but they also have a kind of policing and punishment goal, that is a goal of enforcing compliance with benefit conditions and of meting out sanctions when those conditions are not met. And those two goals, of course, can be in tension with each other. And I'm sure we'll come on to this later in the conversation. But the more that you act like a policeman to people, the more that people are perhaps afraid of you. They're worried about what will happen if they fail to engage with you properly. The harder it actually is to give them real and meaningful help and long-term assistance. So there's been this dual and contradictory role that they've been given, which I think makes their own jobs harder. At the same time, I think the staff working within job centres have been given their own actually quite stressful regime of kind of targets, efficiency drives. The staff themselves, I think, are increasingly not necessarily well-trained and well-supported, and particularly not adequately resourced. And over the last decade in particular, there's been an increasing focus on what we might think of as managerialism, box-ticking, a culture of targets rather than the culture of fully supporting the people that they're working with. So the staff at job centres themselves are under workload pressure. And what that, I think, has led to is a culture of kind of standardization, of dehumanization, of auditing, of checklists, of box ticking. And that has, I think, made it increasingly harder over time to develop the kind of trusting, therapeutic relationship with clients that would actually help them. It's also worth saying that since the early 2010s, some of what job centers used to be done has been taken away from job centers. So there was this thing called the Work Program that was set up by the coalition government in the early 2010s for the long-term unemployed, which actually outsourced support for the long-term unemployed from job centers to basically payments by results providers in the private sector. And many of those have struggled to deal well with the long-term and chronic unemployed because they're paid by results. Many of those organizations, there's some evidence that they've ended up focusing on the easier cases. Those are the cases that will get them the results, that get them their payments. And the really long-term unemployed who need, you know, long-term sustained help are falling through the cracks of that kind of outsourced system, which has become increasingly kind of low-cost, poor-quality, standardized. So job centers have been partly on a journey of decreased resources and more managerialism, of policing alongside doling out help, at the same time as they've actually lost some of their responsibility for the long-term unemployed as well.
Do you think that job centers plus not functioning in the way that we want them to, because politicians have been trying to reform job centers plus for a very long time, right? Every time there is elections, political parties always want to reform job centers plus. They always want to renew them. They always want them to have a different role, and it can go one way or another. Do you think that there is something about the welfare system in the UK that needs more broader, deeper reform? And basically tweaking job centers plus can be a bit of a convenient distraction for politicians, because it can be easier, for example, to say, oh, you know, what we need is to have job centers plus staff just acting as policemen more, being stricter on people who are asking for benefit, rather than looking at deeper problems with our welfare system. Like, for example, why is it that so many people are feel increasingly unable to find meaningful work, sustainable work? Why is it that people are becoming more and more sick? Things like that.
I mean, that's a fantastic question, and I could talk for like an hour about it. So I will try to keep myself under control and give a shorter answer. I think there's a couple of things to say. I mean, one is that it's not really that difficult, I think, to implement some of the changes that would make job centres better, but it would probably require increased resources. And in an era of austerity, unfortunately, benefits claimants are often at the back of the queue for increased resources. And why do we know that? Well, if we look cross-nationally at the amount of money that's given for things like retraining or supporting those in long-term unemployment or with long-term sickness and other conditions, the UK is very far behind most of its comparator countries in the amount that it spends per capita. And so there's a simple resources question, which would undoubtedly make job centres, I think, function more effectively. But I think there's a second and broader point, which is that, you know, there's a limit to the extent to which the user interface of the benefit system can deal with all the problems that politicians want it to deal with. So why, for instance, is there, and there undoubtedly is a problem of people on long-term sickness benefits in the UK that has gone up. Now, why is that happening? is it because Job Centres Plus are not doing enough to push them into work, or is it because the NHS itself has partly collapsed, and it's particularly collapsed in some of the kind of, if you like, quality of life conditions, chronic conditions, the type of conditions that don't necessarily attract massive political resources, but actually make it much, much harder to get to work and to stay in work. And so there's an extent to which actually dealing with the problem requires dealing with some of the other effects of austerity, like the effects on the NHS, but also the effects on things like homelessness services, drug and alcohol treatment services, and other parts of government that themselves are not working well. So I think, yes, we certainly can improve Job Centres Plus, but we should also recognise that the problem is wider, and it's not just a question of the end product of often, you know, years of ill health that perhaps isn't being dealt with by the wider system that we need to address as well.
So is there any problem with the most recent model of Job Centres Plus, where, you know, you have hard targets and there is an element of punishment if someone doesn't do the work that they to show that they're looking for a job? Isn't a danger in the alternative becoming an excuse for people to not work at all and to just stay on benefits, basically?
So that's another great question. Look, there is undoubtedly a small minority of people who could work but don't engage with the system. I'm not going to pretend that there are none of those people. But what we do have now is very, very good evidence on how well the system of sanctioning and monitoring and conditionality has worked in the UK. And that's very good academic evidence. It's evidence from independent organisations. And all of that evidence paints an overwhelmingly negative picture of what's happened. And let me just talk about that a little bit. So as you probably know, one of the main things that's happened since 2010 is a big increase in the use of sanctioning. And sanctioning happens if somebody doesn't comply with one of the conditions for getting what was a range of benefits is now universal credit. And they'll have their benefits removed for some period of time, which can be up to 3 years in the most severe cases. The causal evidence we have is that sanctioning has very little impact on employment rates. Where it does have an impact, it usually pushes people into short-term and often insecure work, which is often interspersed with further periods of unemployment. So the evidence that its use pushes people into sustained and long-term employment is just not there. It doesn't appear to increase people's motivation to seek work. What it does do is, in some cases, drives people out of the benefits system altogether and into things like crime, homelessness, drug use or drug selling or prostitution. And it also has very, very well documented and very clear effects on financial well-being, debt, homelessness, survival crime and other forms of low-level crime, food bank use, mental, physical health, and all other kind of ancillary things that can go along with unemployment, like addiction. And that's been greatly exacerbated by the removal of other schemes that used to support people who had been sanctioned. So there was something called the Social Fund, which used to give kind of emergency money to people who had no other source of funds. That's been removed now. And that means that people who have been sanctioned for really the first time in British history actually literally have nothing to live on for often quite sustained periods of time. And the evidence that this helps to push people into work is just not there. Politicians will talk about it. They will use language like sanctions are designed for people who, quote unquote, refuse to comply with the system. Now, if you actually go and talk to people who are in the system, as many researchers have done, you actually find very clear desire to work, and you actually, interestingly, often find very clear support for the principle that there are rights and responsibilities and that people should have to fulfill some kind of contract in return for getting benefits. Even benefit users themselves will say that. Now, why are people being sanctioned? And we have very good evidence on the reasons for this. It's not usually because people are actively failing to seek work. It's usually things like they don't have enough money to attend job interviews, and if they fail to attend interviews or appointments, they'll be sanctioned. They have clashes of appointments for things like health or addiction. They don't have enough access to the internet, perhaps because they're sleeping rough, or they don't have secure long-term accommodation. They may be living quite chaotic lives, characterized by anxiety and very poor mental health. And the idea that kind of those types of people are going to rationally respond to punitive incentives just isn't there at all. And indeed, quite the opposite, that people's engagement, people's motivation, people's desire for self-improvement, people's self-confidence can all be greatly harmed by a system that basically appears designed to catch them out and to find fault rather than to deal with long-term help. And the final thing to say is that the kind of very meager level of benefits themselves actually exacerbates the problem altogether. So there's very good evidence from psychology that people's so-called mental bandwidth is greatly constrained by the experience of living in insecurity and poverty. So think about a time in your life when you've been very stressed by something, maybe bereavement, anxiety, something like that. Were you making great decisions at that time? Were you finding it easy to focus on the things you needed to focus on? Probably not. Now imagine that you're having to live on the British level of benefits, which evidence shows is not adequate to meet everyday needs such as shelter, food and clothing. And then imagine that at the same time, you're being asked to attend 15 job interviews a week. And if you don't apply them, you'll be sanctioned and you could lose your home or you could lose access to food. And to expect people to make great decisions under those conditions is frankly crazy. And the evidence, unsurprisingly, shows that it doesn't lead to that at all. You know, people with mental health conditions are kind of meeting an uncaring bureaucracy. They're often finding it very hard to buy things like clothes for job interviews, to attend job interviews, et cetera. So kind of starving people of the essentials that they need for everyday life is just not a stable platform for those people to find long-term employment.
This is such an important point that by making people more stressed out, you are harming their mental health. You are making them less able to be economically active and contribute. You sent me a very interesting study about the benefit cap and the impact that the benefit cap has on employment levels and economic inactivity. And it was saying that while some people it will have a positive effect on employment, for a lot more of them, it will actually, the benefit cap made them economically inactive, because it did mean that people who have caring responsibilities, people who have kids more often than not, they would not be able to take up more work for the very basic, for simply because of the way their life is structured and you know, the kind of life that you live when you have to take care of children and other dependents.
I mean, exactly. And that's a very good example of another area where the failings of the benefit system are not really failings of the benefit system. They're failings of other parts of government. That we have a very inadequate system of publicly provided childcare in the UK. And of course, the people affected by the benefits cap often have large families. So of course, it's going to be harder for them to get into paid work. And, you know, a very reasonable alternative policy would be to make sure that their childcare needs are met and they're met for free.
So tell me, this is a very difficult area, right? Because it's very difficult because the public very often, we have this perception in politics that everyone hates benefit scroungers and we should be really, really hard for people and that people are not working because they don't want to work, which I don't think is true. I think that human beings, we want to be productive. We want to contribute meaningfully to society. And most people do not want to just survive on meagre welfare benefits. Most people want to thrive. Most people, given the choice, I believe, would rather work than depend on benefits. How can politicians shape public opinion in this area rather than be slaves to what in their minds are voters' biases and the bad image of people who are coming in who are coming in touch with the welfare system?
Well, one thing to say is actually that the public have become quite a bit more supportive of the benefit system in recent years. I partly think they've recognised what's happened with poverty, they've recognised what's happened with universal credit and other cuts, and realised that people are struggling. So it is an easier environment for politicians than it was in the past. But beyond that, you know, public opinion is not some monolithic entity that exists separately from the realm of politics. We know very clearly, and this is something that I show in the book and in my work, the way in which politicians talk about issues really affects the way the public thinks about them. And most people, if you talk to them, if you do qualitative work, think more than one thing at the same time. They'll probably say something like, yes, people who are on benefits, you know, probably should do something in return for it, and we should reasonably expect that people are trying to contribute. But at the same time, you know, anybody can become unemployed, and when they become unemployed, they should be helped. And so the simplest thing that politicians can do is just to emphasize those values, those ideas that the public already have, that already exist. So you can talk about welfare as a human right. You can talk about the idea that it's something we may all depend on. We can talk about the idea that, yes, people should fulfill some conditions in return, but we should also treat them with dignity and with respect, and we should try to help them with the conditions that they need. They need help with beyond just not having a job. But I also think beyond that, politicians should think about the ways in which policies themselves frame their users, if you like. You know, the more that benefits are meager and provided to a minority, the easier it is to frame that minority as deviant or as somehow outside the kind of moral universe of society, which is also what's happened in this country. So in the book, you know, I call for a return to a more universal conception of what welfare is. And actually, if you look over people's lifetimes, of course, most of us, all of us, in fact, on average, pretty much pay in what we get out from the welfare state. If you look at what people use from the NHS, from the pension system, and so on, over our lifetimes, all of us are contributors and all of us are takers at some point. And that's another thing, of course, that politicians can emphasize. So while I'm not pretending that it's easy, I don't think it's an impossible task for politicians to simply start talking about the kind of nascent ideas that citizens already have.
One last question, very quickly. Why do you think it's so hard to build a system to get people who can't work to find meaningful work?
I'm not sure that it is that hard. I just think it requires more resources. It requires an approach that aims to deal with the actual problems. And it requires a kind of long-term commitment to it. Look, we can spend more on chronic health conditions in NHS, which will really help people with disabilities get back into work. If you ask people with disabilities, as you've already said, the overwhelming majority of them are desperate to work and to contribute, but they find things like access very, very difficult. We can deal with those problems. I don't think it's impossible. Sure, look, there are a minority of people who are going to find it very, very hard to get jobs, and we'll probably need to concentrate resources on them. But I don't think we should pretend that this is some kind of impossible task that requires a Herculean effort. It probably just, in some ways, requires us to fund public service properly. And why do we know that? Well, if we go back to the mid-2000s, prior to the financial crisis, Britain was seen as the world leader in getting people from welfare back into work. And we were doing a very good job back then. We had adequately funded systems. Sure, there was some problems, but overall, we were doing what we did very, very well, in many ways simply because it was well-funded. And so I just think it requires a commitment from politicians to get it right, rather than a commitment to kind of what's happening at the moment, I think, which is using benefits policy to send a message about who's in and who's out in terms of society's moral universe, which I think is the focus of what we've done over the last decade.
Amazing. We are finishing this episode on a positive note then. Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you, Stella.
To learn more about Catch-22's manifesto, check out the link in our show notes. If you liked this episode, please rate, follow, and leave us a review. Thank you.